you.
No, you're... Oh, this is Muriel Gutman, and I am doing an oral history project for Council of Jewish Women, and I have the privilege of interviewing Mr. Stanley Levin. Mr. Levin lives at 63 L.A. Monitor Street in Pittsburgh. Mr. Levin...
I just want to... I want to check.
Are we ready?
Mm-hmm.
Today's date is July 26, 1982. Mr. Levin, we'd like to know, in addition to the information you've given us, something about your family, your father, your mother, brothers, sisters. Were they born in this country?
Well, my mother was born right here in Pittsburgh, so we're old Pittsburghers. My grandfather, her father, my mother's father, came here in 1860. And it might be interesting, at least these are the stories he told me. He came here in a sailboat.
In a sailboat,
and it took 6 months to get here.
From where?
From Russia. Came from Russia. And we're Litvaks, if that means anything to you. And so, from Lithuania, as it was called then. And so we're old-time Pittsburghers. Mother was born here. My father was born in Russia, so have a Russian background.
And it's your Russian father that came on the sailboat.
My grandfather.
Your grandfather.
My
came
grandfather
on the
in 1860, of course. Yes.
1860.
Now,
as far man. As,
pardon me.
He's been a very brave man.
Well,
sailboat,
he came here, of course, to escape the all the things that most Jews, the same reason most Jews came to America, and we were. Came to America. My father was in the cigar business, one of the old-time cigar makers. And he had a big factory up near the old Passman Hospital
in
the Hill District. That's correct. He employed about 300 people, so he had a big factory.
Oh, you
and most
say
people
the Hill
in
District,
Pittsburgh.
Not North Hill. That's
no,
the
no,
Hill
up
District.
In the Hill District.
Hill District.
That's right.
Was the original
most, they call them Toby makers then. That's the Pittsburgh Stogie, which became famous historically.
Oh, I didn't know Pittsburgh Stogie became.
That's right. And he had a big factory. Well, anybody who came over in Pittsburgh probably worked for my father. He was one of the old-time cigar makers.
Where did they get their tobacco at that time?
From
Cuba
all over.
Or from
all over the country. There are all kinds of tobacco to go into that business. Very complicated. But that's basically the family itself. I was a twin, if that's interesting. My mother had four children in all. And my brother, I was a twin. My brother died, my twin brother died when he was just 3 months old. So, and my other brother was killed in the service in World War II. And I have a sister who lives in Penn Hills. I'm not married. I don't know if you knew that or not. So I'm single. Nobody would have me, and I can understand why. But
musicians are married to their
music.
Oh,
I see. That's right. And anyhow, my education was a normal education of somebody in Pittsburgh. We lived up in the hill, so I went to Old Fifth Avenue High School up in the hill. And from there, we had no money, of course, right after the Depression.
Those are things that I definitely want to hear about, but in order of background, did your father or mother have a music background?
No, but it was most interesting. My father, without a musical background, went to every concert. As a kid, he took me to every concert that came to Pittsburgh. I did have, he had relatives in his family that were musicians. The Anna Perlow, you may know that name, is a cousin of mine. And so that's on his side of the family. In fact, the music school was named, at the Settlement House is named after her. And she was my cousin.
I see.
So that's the mishpocha, as we say. And so I went to school, and there's no money, but I got a scholarship and went to Duquesne University.
What about in your home? What was the economically? You were probably very comfortable in your home.
Well,
your father had a cigar factory.
Until the Depression. Then after the Depression, we had nothing. Well, my father lost everything he had through a fire, and he could not insure tobacco was terribly expensive, so he never carried insurance, and the place burned down.
What kind of a religious atmosphere was there in
very
your
home? Well, very religious. My grandfather, who lived with me, with at home with my parents, of course. In fact, as a child, I slept in the room with him. And so I was brought up in a very, very diligent fashion. I had a rabbi who came to the house and taught me privately. I never went to a Haver as the other kids did. I was taught privately. And in fact, there was a time when I considered going to the rabbinate myself as a very young person in my early teens. And I learned to speak Hebrew and write Hebrew, and in fact, when I went away to teach, related to the religious aspect, I went to a town to teach school where there were no Jews. My father was sure I would lose all my Jewish heritage, and so he insisted that I write him a letter every week in Yiddish, which I did. And for 3 years, I wrote him a letter, which kept up my Yiddish. Of course, yes.
Did your parents speak Yiddish in the home?
Yes. My mother, who was born here, no one of the natives who were almost born in Europe, never would believe that she was born in America because she spoke Yiddish so well. But her father, who lived with us, was only Yiddish spoken at home. So that's how I retained that as a child. That's all as far as Jewish.
What was, when you were growing up, what was Pittsburgh like?
Well, I suppose I saw them much of the Depression. As a very young man, my father was pretty well to do at one time when I was a very young child. For example, at my bar mitzvah, he was the president of the shul, and he threw a party and fed the whole congregation.
What shul was that?
It's the old Beth Jacob, Beth Yaakov shul.
Is that the one that's still downtown?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know.
Oh, that's not the one near the Central Medical Facility.
I don't think so. I don't think so. No, and soon after that, there was very little. In fact, there was a time we were on relief. That's how bad it got. When he lost everything, he had it every, and it was like many things happened. You ask about those days in the 29s, 30s, 31, 32. When after the Depression hit, people who had things had nothing, literally nothing. And it was a very, very tragic time. When the people speak of the good old days, they were hardly good old days.
Let me ask you, what year were you born in? I'm sure it must be on your...
You have to know that.
I don't have to know.
No, it's not on there.
Honey, do you want to tell us?
In the 1800s.
In the 1800s.
You're not going to be specific. Okay.
Doesn't matter.
Okay. Well, you don't look it.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly don't. That's from not marrying.
No,
wives make you get old.
That's what they tell me. That's what they tell me. 39. That's what Jack Benny said.
That's right. Me too.
Was there a lot of culture in Pittsburgh at that time when you were growing up?
As the Pittsburgh Symphony, if you want to speak of the top level organization, the Pittsburgh Symphony had a series of concerts and very few in number.
You can answer.
You ask how strict my parents were at home, discipline-wise. It was always done with a loving care. However, There were certain disciplines that we as kids had to do. For example, when I was 5 years of age, my father brought a violin home. He didn't say to me, honey, do you want to play it? How do you feel about it? He didn't say that. He just brought a fiddle home, and he said, next Tuesday night, you're going to take your first violin lesson. I didn't even know what it was. I remember sitting on a table, there was this small violin. And the following Tuesday night, I started my fiddle lessons. Now, after that, for a period of, a long time, for 6 or 7 years, every time when my father came home from work, the first thing he said to my mother, did he practice? And if I hadn't practiced, I wanted to play out in the street with the other kids. If I hadn't practiced, he'd get your fiddle out. And I'd practice with the tears running down my eyes. And he sat in the chair reading. I remember he used to read the Forward's newspaper. While I was playing the violin and my mother screaming, the soup's getting cold, he said, look, you didn't want to stand over a hot stove. I didn't want to go to work today particularly. He has a chore, that's it. So every day for a half hour, and to save a lot of embarrassment and a lot of problems, I used to practice. I didn't particularly love it until after I learned to play and he started to show off and I started to play a little bit, among the family, then you take a different approach. You turn a kid on, then that's all you have to do.
But
at first,
it was
very difficult.
You started when you were 5 years old.
I was 5 years old when I started.
Yeah, most people want their children, they took piano lessons. When I raised my children, they all had to take piano lessons.
Well,
but
sure.
It was a Jewish thing in those days.
The boys play the fiddle and the girls play the piano.
Why do you think that was so important to Jewish
people?
Well,
I think that the violin was, they used to, I say this in parentheses, the violin is a Jewish instrument. It's been proven maybe not so, however, but the Jewish people love the violin. I don't know what the cultural impulse was, or what characteristic about the sound of the violin, but there have been so many great violinists historically who were Jewish. I don't know why, what attraction there is to a string instrument, but it's been so historically. Now many psychologists, this has been looked into many, many times, and there's, other than the fact that they played the violin in Europe, it was identified very closely. I have a strange suspicion that the other instruments were too expensive. To play a violin can be made with very cheaply, you understand, but where if you played a trumpet or a flute or a clarinet, they began to become too expensive. Now, that may be a simple answer.
I just wonder what there is about. Would it be easier if I sat there and you just look at one?
No, that's just okay. You're okay.
No,
are you comfortable?
I'm fine. I just thought if I sat there, you wouldn't be turning so much. What is there about Jewish people that feels it's very important for is it identified with Jewish people that their children learn music?
Well, I think that historically Jewish people have always been involved in the fine arts. Except originally in painting, in the graphic arts, because, and there's a religious reason for that, we were not permitted to make an image of anything.
Idolatry.
So the image of God, or you hide your face and so forth, that you're not to make an image of something. Whereas in music, that was not forbidden, you see. And so that's why music became the greater emphasis than painting or as other cultures have developed. Originally, I don't know historically of too many great artists who came from our milieu, our background, in Russia particularly, or Middle Europe. And
when art was religious too.
There was another concept. They developed vocally singing from a singing point of view. There was much singing done because it is forbidden according to the Torah. I don't mean to impress you with knowledge, but that you are not allowed to say the words that's in the Torah. When you're at the Torah, you chant it. You must speak in a different kind of a voice. house.
I didn't know
you
that.
You know, use street language when you're saying, when you say a bracha, and you speak at the Torah, so you chant.
Oh, I didn't know that that was why they chant.
That's the reason. And that's the beginning of it, that you must. And then, of course, the ultra-Orthodox is not only do you do it with your voice, you do it with your whole body, and you sit and shake, and you must express your total human being vocally, and therefore, the more you shake, the more religious you are. And I suppose the Holy Roller started with that, the Quakers. They quake.
Interesting. Where did you go to grade school?
I went to a school in the old Moorhead School, which has since been torn down. And I like to refer myself as to the oldest living alumnus.
This is in the Hill. In the Hill
Up
District.
In the Hill District.
In the Hill District.
And from there I went to Fifth Avenue High School.
That was at the Moorhead?
Moorhead. Moorhead.
Mm-hmm. And then to Fifth Avenue.
Went to Fifth Avenue High School. Then I went, these are my early days.
Yes,
now,
we want to know where
curious.
You're coming from. We have lots of time.
That's okay. And then from there I went to, as I say, from fifth I went to Duquesne University. I had a 4-year scholarship. They speak to the cost of education today. I paid $13 a year for my college education. And what was the 13 bucks? Burned me up. I had to buy an athletic ticket. That was $13. See? And then, well, that was the beginning.
Right,
and
now,
then,
when you grew up in the Hill, were there mostly Jewish people?
All Jewish people. Well, yes.
Mostly. I mean, like today it's predominantly
all my friends
black,
were Jewish,
it's predominantly
yes.
Jewish.
All my friends were Jewish, except that I can recall as a youngster, I had a very good friend who was a black boy with whom I shared many of my personal feelings, and he with me. He was a very nice boy. I don't know whatever happened to him, but I remember him. I remember his name, Fedris Birch.
Interesting.
And a very interesting, a very black boy. And it was interesting, the Jewish concept. I was never allowed to go to his home, nor was he ever invited to my home. That was a kind of a no-no thing.
Because
I can
of
understand
color
the tray,
or religion? Or
it was tray, first of all. I couldn't eat there. Mother was afraid. And he wasn't invited to my home. I don't know why not. I can't remember that. Whereas the other Jewish kid did come into the house. But I never shared a glass of milk and cookies or whatever that the other kids did.
What about the teachers? Were there any teachers like in grade school that
inspired me, so to speak? Well, in elementary school, I can't remember any specific one. However, in high school, I did have a music teacher. These were the days of the long after the Depression, the days of the Depression when things were very bad. My personal home life during high school were very unhappy for me because there was nothing. There was just no money for me. And it was very bad. Bad scene.
Did they, in grade school, I mean, did they have at that time opportunities for youngsters to play instruments? When I went to school,
no.
There was a school orchestra and
no.
There were instruments
nothing
there.
Nothing like that in elementary school. It was just vocal music. That's right. No, they didn't have instrumental. They did in high school. But that was unusual, too. You had to know how to play. I recall that when I first came to high school, I was auditioned by the high school teacher to get into the school orchestra. So there were no special classes where you learned
to
play instruments, as they do today.
How were the kids in the classroom? Did they have discipline problems?
Listen,
as
a school teacher, I can tell you, I hear this question all the time, you know, what's the difference? There was a big difference. You know what the difference was, I think? That the kids who turned 16 quit. Those who were, probably have become discipline problems, and we're not in school. They quit school. And so since the state law requires that they go to school, so you have them in school. And the answer to that, is it better for them to be out in the streets and create problems of a much greater nature than to be in school and have a little discipline problem? Of course, that's the question that can be argued on both sides. What do you do? By the way, it's currently the great issue in New York City today. I read in the New York Times just last week that Shanker, the president of the teachers, National Teachers Union, was asking that question. They're back to the basics, that if you don't learn, get out. Now, what are you going to do with these kids? Or don't promote them. So what are you going to have a kid 60 years old in the third grade?
Forever.
What are you going to do with them? And do you want that child 16 who will be a menace to the other kids in the class, menace to the school, to himself, be a very unhappy boy, can't quit school. So what can you do with him? So that's a big question. And then he'll certainly never want to learn anyhow. So it can work against characteristically. So what is school supposed to do? Just teach subjects or teach character too? So you're back in that circle again. You go around the rosy, you never know. Very serious problem.
As you were growing up and you were an adolescent, was that about the time of the Depression as an adolescent?
Yes.
What'd you do for fun or recreation, or did you have to work after school?
Well, there was no work. The parents weren't. Nobody was working. And you had to, shall I give you a terrible instance, a terrible story?
Sure.
When I taught school, I was invited by the school board. I used to be a kind of a voice for the school board. I used to go around to the various PTA organizations in the Pittsburgh schools and give speeches and talks. And one of the talks was the crime rate among adolescents. What are you going to do about it? And I said, well, I have to tell you, standing in front of you, you're looking at a crook that I stole. Now let me tell you what I stole. During the height of the Depression that you're talking about. The biggest problem in our home, since it was a big Jewish home, was Friday night Shabbos. You had to make dinner for Shabbos. That was a big thing in our home. Well, it was on a Wednesday or a Thursday, and my father wasn't working, and my mother was very concerned. There was nothing to eat for Shabbos. I was most concerned about my father. That was a big thing for him. And I loved him very much. And so, it was Thursday morning. I went down to the local grocery store, and I asked the man, I remember his name, Mr. Young, Young's Grocery. I asked him if I could work and clean up or stock or do anything. I was then maybe 13, 14 years old. Is there something I can do? I don't want any money. Give me just some food. He said. He took me in the back of the room, and there were four or five other kids doing this same thing that I wanted. He said, I can't take all the kids on the street, hundreds of kids like that. And he said, I'm sorry. I remember I had a lumberjack on. And see, he stayed in the back. And as I walked out of the place, they had herring used to come in a barrel. And I reached in and I took a herring out. I stuck it in my lumberjack. Now, did I steal that herring? Yes, I stole that herring. And I took it home, and I brought it home, and then I didn't realize what a problem I was going to get into. And my mother said, where'd you get the herring? And I told her the truth. She said, but your father won't eat a stolen herring for Shabbos. Particular Shabbos, you're not going to eat that herring. What are you going to do? I said, well, I'll tell him I work for Mr. Young. She said, you want to lie to him? You go ahead, not me. But that's all in your head. You arrange whatever you want. You do what you want. So when he came home, she said, well, don't worry, we have it. She borrowed a potato next door and an onion, so you're gonna eat. That was our dinner. And he says, oh, that's wonderful. Where did you get the herring? He says to my mother. She says, standing up. Oh, where did you get the herring? Mr. Young said, oh, what a fine man he is. So he said, what did you do? Well, you work in a store. I said, So the upshot out was he ate that. And I had a terrible time because he saw Mr. Young and thanked him. Mr. Young told me he did not have any. that I must have stolen the heroin. Well, my father came home. He would never hit me. My father never laid a hand on me. He sat me down and he told me that I was past 13 and this sin was on me. And he felt terrible that I would steal. And that's it. You evaluate that what you want. I discount that at all. I'm more unhappy than I've ever been with you in my life. That killed me. I absolutely. So I never stole after that, but I stole heroin. And so if that makes me a crook, so when I hear of the kids today, I don't know what info. I'm not saying they're all that way. I'm not speaking of a guy who robs a Brinks truck for $500,000, but a guy who steals a piece of candy or something else. What motivation there is, I don't know. But I'm a softie anyway, so I don't know about that. I can never find out what's motivating, what's in your head now, what motivates people is the most difficult thing.
But I think parents' attitudes have changed. I know that when my youngest son was going to grade school and junior high school, their parents, the kids would come home with new clothes and their parents never questioned.
Well, that's another story, see. I'm sure that that you would ask a question, where did you get it? It's a natural thing to ask. But, you see, these things are very difficult. But I find most of life becomes more and more complicated. You're little, a little problem, yeah. You get older, the bigger problem. Until we reach the biggest, bigger questions, and none of us really knows what to do.
How is our tape running?
Oh, I'm lost. I'm getting lost here. What number did I say? Yes, I think. Well, no, we're at 4:14, so we have a little bit to go, but I'm glad you mentioned it.
You mentioned your bar mitzvah. Would you like to tell us about it?
Well,
you said it was big,
I said,
and your father...
I gave two speeches, one in Hebrew and one in Yiddish, and three, and one in English. And I wrote my speeches myself, and I said the whole Torah.
Who was your... teacher, rabbi?
Rabbi's name was Ashinsky. Rabbi Ashinsky was one of the oldest rabbis in Pittsburgh. He was a little old man, I recall him very well. But he loved my father and the family. He would come to our home, mostly because it was very kosher, but most of the homes were kosher in those days. I wore tzitzis to school and up until I went to college.
But that wasn't so unusual. There
were kids who wore them. I wasn't the only one. But it wasn't, I don't think it was a general thing. But in our home, I got up every morning, put my tefillin on after my bed, with my Zadie, with my grandfather. Mm-hmm. And I would say my prayers in the morning with my grandfather. I never questioned it. It was the thing to do. He asked me to do it, and Friday night, I'd go to shul with him. But later on, after he came home and he went to bed, I snuck out. So that came later.
What'd you do for fun? You didn't have any money.
It was just a simple thing.
Swimming,
we used to go
lakes,
to a movie
rivers.
For a dime.
What movies were in the city then?
Oh, in those days up on the hill, there was the Center Square, the old Victoria Theater. Victoria, the Center Square. And then... when I was 12 years old, I got a job playing in the old Lando Theater. It was a Jewish theater. Jewish actors came to Pittsburgh from New York. It was
I didn't know there was Jewish theater.
Oh, yes.
I didn't know
that. All Jewish theater. And I was in the orchestra when I was 12 years old. So I was able to make money more than the other boys up in the hill because I could perform. I always played Jewish weddings.
What, you played violin?
No, that was mostly, I did play a little bit. I switched my instrument later, and I became a very good flute player, and I got a 4-year scholarship playing the flute, and clarinet and saxophone, in fact. I played with Kay Kaiser later on, so I toured for about 2 years.
What was the name of the Jewish theater in...
Lando, L-A-N-D-O.
And that was in the Hill
District. I was up in the
Hill
District on Robertson Center Avenue.
Who owned the theater?
Lando Theater.
Is that local?
You know the Lando Real Estate Company? That was the grandfather, I think. The grandfather.
What What about the movie theaters, the Nickelodeons or whatever they were? Who
well,
else
no,
does?
No, 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 no.
Well, I don't know what they
long were. After Nickelodeons, but
I don't know what
there
they
were regular theaters. It was the I say, the Victoria and the Center Square. Yeah, I mentioned those.
Were these the theaters where somebody played the piano while the silent movies were?
Well, they weren't silent
this,
movies.
Oh, you were
well,
bowing
I'm
the
after,
sound. Okay, I'm trying
that.
To place the
yeah.
time.
I don't remember the silent movies. I'm not that.
Well, I even remember the piano players when the movies were
in
sound
between,
movies. I mean, they used to.
They, oh, they had piano players. In fact, one
Dick
of the.
Dick Powell used to.
They
do
used
that?
To. Oh, no, 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 no. That's in the. You're talking about downtown at the Penn
yeah,
and Stanley
yeah.
Theater.
Yeah.
They had floor shows.
Oh.
Every theater had a floor show, and Dick Powell and some of those people, they had a big stage show. I tell you what is comparable to today to the Rockettes in New York.
Yeah.
They still maintain the same procedure. There's a movie and then
and
a
then
big
the
floor
stage
show.
Show.
Yeah. Big stage show.
Right.
And
yeah,
that's
I,
what
I remember
had,
that.
The Stanley and Penn.
And that's where Dick Powell was involved.
That's
I remember
Dick Powell.
That.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay.
So, did you play baseball? Did you play?
Oh, sure. I played with all the kids on the street.
Swim baseball. In the river?
No, no. I never went swimming. That was another long story I want to go into. But my father threw me into a